This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 69. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Rob?
I'm doing quite good. I have finished the billing engine for Hittail.
Yeah, it's all done. Were you late?
I finished it. No, I finished it in the nick of time. I didn't have to stay up till 2 a.m. as I had predicted, but I did have to. I wound up spending probably 3 or 4 hours, quote unquote, finishing it. Remember, I said a contractor had built it and tested it, said it worked, and I knew that it wasn't. You know, you just expect it not to be. And so I did spend about 4 hours. And what was nice is that the bulk of the code was there. There was a bunch of, it saved me a bunch of time, but there were some very subtle things that he had missed in the spec. So I just had to change some ifs around and change some logic. I mean, if I tried to write it from scratch, it would have been 20 to 25 hours probably. I spent 4 hours on it, so I wasn't pretty happy with it. And I got it done in time. And you know what? I actually have been just so pleasantly surprised with, or not surprised, but just amazingly happy with the way that step through debugging is working for me, because I'm basically running it from my desktop and I'm connecting to the database to pull the records out, and then I'm stepping through the code and watching it. And what it's done is, you know, it allows me to kind of fix the code as I'm going, instead of having, because, you know, when you put something up on a server and then schedule it to run every night, it's like you need all this error checking code. You need tons of emails being sent out, because if anything goes wrong, you need to know about it so you can fix it. And being able to step through it has been really cool and has saved me a lot of time, and actually shown me a lot of different data points that I wouldn't have realized were kind of bad in the database that I've been able to fix.
Do you have like a local copy of it, or
the database?
Yeah.
No, I actually connect across the, I open the port and then I connect, run it, and then I close it. Yep.
Got it.
Yeah, that's been good. It's always fun to get back into the code, you know, like just to get into some technology and kind of build something. How about you? What's been going on?
I've been sick for the past couple of days. Yeah, so pretty much my entire family went down with what we believe is the norovirus. The onset is about, for me, it was an hour. For my wife, it was about 90 minutes. But basically, you go from completely functional to just on the floor in pain for at least a couple of days. And then after that, you know, you've got lingering effects for up to a couple of weeks. But so far, the only one who's been spared is my oldest son. And he's got a birthday party coming up on Saturday. So we're hoping he'll be spared. But we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, it. You told me about it, and I was going to call it the bubonic plague on the podcast, because that's what it sounds like to me. I was working in a coffee shop yesterday and today, and I wanted to have two monitors, and so I downloaded, I bought Air Display, which is an iOS app for my iPad, and it's $10 in the App Store, and you can use it as a second monitor over Wi-Fi.
Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, so I recommend it to folks. It's there's a little bit of latency, obviously. You know, I have my little 13-inch laptop, and then I have the little 10.1-inch screen next to it propped up, and it was working shockingly well today as I was moving things, you know, from one window to another. And not nearly as fast as a, you know, real dual monitor setup, but certainly super portable. That's what I liked about it, is that I could take in the ambiance and the caffeine of a coffee shop without sacrificing too much productivity.
So you're basically carrying around a couple of screens.
Yeah, isn't it cool? Yeah, it was funny. And I had several people comment on it. They're like, oh, are those connected? And I was like, yeah, baby, over the Wi-Fi.
I read somewhere that Apple may be introducing the iPad 3 in the first week of March, and preliminary potential specs for the screen are something like 2,000 pixels by 1,000 pixels or something like that.
Yeah.
Something ridiculous.
So what is it, like OLED, or it's like a super high-end screen that they're saying that they're going to use?
But I could imagine using a MacBook Air with that right next to it. That'd be awesome.
Seriously. Cool. It just hammered the battery, dude. It went from 99% down to 10% in like 5 or 6 hours.
Well, you know, I mean, that's still pretty good, though. I mean, even for video, I mean, you're only going to get 10 hours out of it to begin with.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah,
that's not that bad.
Yeah.
That's actually pretty good.
How about for you? You were up in Canada?
So I've come to the realization that when you go into Canada, if you're going to fly through Toronto, their entire customs system is a complete and utter scam. You know, I didn't come to this conclusion completely independently. I talked to several other people, and they basically said the same thing. Some of them were Canadian, some of them were American, and they all basically said the same thing. In Toronto, the customs is just terrible. So I went there. I'm working for an American company that has a Canadian subsidiary, and the contracts are all with the American company, and everything's there. I've got all this paperwork and and stuff that basically shows all this, and they made me buy a work visa. It was like $150. I'm like, well, I need to get into the country, and I'm supposed to hop on my next flight in about 2 hours here. What's going on? How can we do this? He's like, oh, there's a cashier over there. You can pay for a work visa, and we'll let you go.
Wow.
Just like, you have got to be kidding me.
That's awesome. And they're like, please pay in cash, small bills, unmarked. And
something.
As you turn around, they just start handing it out to the crew.
It was ridiculous. You know, it comes down to a business expense that gets written off at the end of the day anyway. But still, it's just a total scam.
Right. That's funny. So, hey, we are up to 87 ratings in iTunes, which is just
very nice.
Awesome. And as we said, we're trying to get to 125 before MicroConf, which is cool. Now, there's been this whole discussion of like the international reviews, because our editor went to Australia and she said, yeah, there were, I don't remember, 8 or 10. Or
I think it was 8, yeah.
In the Australian iTunes. And if you scroll all the way down in iTunes and go to the bottom right, there's like a flag. There's an American flag. If you click on it, it brings up a whole page of flags and you can just switch between them. You click on it, it sends you all the way back to the homepage of the iTunes store. You research for it again and then go back. So it would be like incredibly time consuming to actually try to figure out how many reviews you really have worldwide. But anyways, it is interesting nonetheless. I mean, assuming there are major hubs that listen to us, flip through some of the Western Europe reviews. But there were some really cool reviews from the past couple of weeks.
So are we going to leverage this to boost our numbers when we talk to the guys over at Texan?
Yeah, like totally talk about add in the Australian ones. Yeah.
Yeah, we're like, oh, we're at 200 plus.
Yeah, nice. Did I read this one already? It was from the Schmitzer, and it says, my iPhone lost its downloaded podcast after upgrading to iOS 5. With little time to download them this morning, I had to answer the question. If you could listen to only one podcast today, what would it be? I immediately downloaded Stardust for the Rest of Us. Isn't that awesome? That's awesome. And there's another one. So this is Rob Bazinet. He lives out in Connecticut. Longtime listener of this podcast, have followed the work of Rob since I can remember. This podcast is the podcast I look for each week. Mike and Rob cover the topics every startups face, and these guys don't cover the topics in theory, but from practical experience. So it's huge because they explain what works and what doesn't, as well as how to get there. So that's cool. Really appreciate that, Rob. And Tim High actually posted a comment. I've seen him on the interwebs a few times. The value to time ratio on this podcast is exceptionally high. These guys stay on topic and know how to get to the point. So as always, we really appreciate those reviews, guys. If nothing else, it makes Mike and I feel good and makes me want to really, go the extra mile to record cool episodes.
Yeah, there was an email that we got from Ryan Wagner. He runs the website 21times.org. His message was, hi guys, I run a mailing list, 21times.org, for developers who want to build and launch a product of their own. We have a few thousand subscribers, and I just sent out a link to episode 66 to them since I really enjoyed it. Tell Mike that I really felt his pain when facing those tough questions. Launching is hard. We'd love a tweet or mention of 21 Times if you feel it's appropriate. Either way, thanks for the great episode, Ryan. So thanks for that, Ryan. I appreciate it. It was not an easy episode to go through. I think Rob kind of felt a little bit, I wouldn't say embarrassed, a little bit bad for me, I guess.
Right. But there were certainly a lot of, comments, both positive and negative, from listeners. There was kind of a nice discussion going on in the comment thread on the blog.
Yeah, we did get a lot of comments on that one episode. But thanks very much for your comments, Ryan. And thanks to everybody who posted on the StartupsForTheRestOfUs.com website in the comments there.
Right. If you haven't checked that out, I mean, there's 20-something comments. It's by far the most we've had on any episode. So it's a pretty fascinating discussion. And what's cool is to see people's different viewpoints of it. It's like some people are really negative about, I don't know, about the prospects of it, or say like you should shut it down, you should just kill it. And others are like, no, you should pivot, and you need to find the market. And there's just a lot of different ideas, and it just shows you how complex this stuff is, right? There's like so many ways to look at it. Honestly, you're an entrepreneur, you got to go with your gut, man.
Today's episode comes from a listener. So this email is from Nick Burdick, and he writes, Mike and Rob, I'm a huge fan of the show. The clear, concise info you guys put together is completely invaluable to a starting entrepreneur. I'm in the process of getting my family meal planning app, GrubGuru.com, ready to launch in the next few months. And that's spelled GrubGuroo.com. I'm fairly new to SEO, and the volume of information out there is really overwhelming. I'm curious to what your suggestion is for the top 5 to 10 things to get started doing with SEO for your site. Is it blogging, building links by guest posting, on page, off page, etc.? Thanks, and keep up the great work, Nick.
You know, I think I'll start before we say a word about this. We have had the request to talk about SEO and AdWords and pay-per-click stuff. We probably receive that once a month, and we don't talk about it. And the reason is because it's plain boring, honestly. Now, we've covered these topics in depth in the Academy because you can cover them in written form and in screencasts a lot easier than just you and I sitting here chatting about it. So I think today's format is not, it's not some step-by-step of first insert meta tags, right? That is like horrendously boring stuff. And frankly, you can find that either in a place like the Academy or, you know, just in checklists on the web or, you know, other resources. So I think we're going to take a little different approach to it today. And I do like the thought of taking the top five things rather than trying to cover this massive subject all at once.
So I think for this episode, where Nick asked kind of specifically, what are the things to do to get started? So I think what we're going to mostly concentrate on is the initial phases of what to do for SEO. And these are the things that you typically have a lot more direct control over. So they're, you know, more about the on-page factors and how you structure your website. And we'll talk a bit briefly about some of the off-page factors, but those are things that you don't necessarily have absolute control over. And they're not things that you can address I don't want to say they're more time-consuming. I mean, they just tend to take place over a much longer period of time. Would that be the way you'd characterize it?
Yeah, there is. There's the on-page factors tend to be something you do once, and it is a more of a checklist approach where it's like, do this, do that. Okay, now you're set. And then it's like you said, the off-page factors, that's the ongoing process of it. And frankly, depending on your comfortability with kind of white hat and gray hat versus black hat techniques, I mean, different people approach off-page factors, meaning like link building and such. Different people approach them very, very differently. And so, like you said, there's certainly not enough time. I mean, you and I could probably riff on just the on-page factors for a couple hours, and the off-page factors are really where a lot of the discussion online happens.
So we're going to go through what we came up with for the five best things to do when it comes to SEO. And the first one is to do keyword research. Before you do anything else, do keyword research, because you have to know what it is you're aiming at and how difficult it is to do before you go out and do full-blown site designs and develop all the content for your site. You really need to know what it is that you're going to be targeting before you can start developing that content.
Right. I think this is something that people often ignore, especially.
Oh, I ignore it sometimes.
Yeah. No, I agree.
I know that I'll go off in left field sometimes, and I'll just start building some of the content for a site. And I think it's very easy to do. But if you're just getting started into SEO, I mean, I think that doing that keyword research is really the place to start.
Right. And there's this fine balance, right? It's like, you definitely want to write for humans because conversions are more important than SEO. However, it is pretty easy to tweak on-page factors towards a certain particular keyword you want to target. It's pretty easy to do that and still leave it feeling very natural to the reader. I know that there are a few different approaches. There's going after head terms, which are terms that have, you know, quite a bit of volume. We really got to start at the beginning, huh? Go to the Google AdWords keyword tool and search for something you think people might use, keywords people might use to search for your site or your product. And you look to see what the volume of that is. And you want to make it an exact match search, and you want to look in your locale. So like, you know, if you're in the US, US only, then you want to look at the local search volume for that. And my guess is you're going to be disappointed, because you think that there are thousands of people searching for, you know, inventory software or even PHP inventory software, you know, whatever app you're building. And typically it's way, way, way less than you think. So what that means is you can often grab that, you know, that term, that generic term, inventory software. But then you got to start putting some thought into what are the surrounding terms, what terms are related to this that could potentially, you know, also bring in traffic. And so you can either go purely long tail, and that's where you really go after terms that are, you know, just much less popular. And actually, that's the whole point of Hittail, frankly, is that it, as soon as you start getting some traffic, you put Hittail on it, and it starts telling you long tail terms that you should be going after. The Google AdWords keyword tool does not do a very good job of giving you long tail terms. It tends to leave them out or say there's no search volume, when in fact there might be 50 or 100 or 200 people searching for something. So that, you know, that's a way to work yourself into a market, is by just consistently publishing stuff about long tail terms. And then I think the other parts that I've seen work really well is to go after a related thing that your prospects might be searching for that could lead them to your app. So instead of inventory software, maybe someone might search for like inventory tracking word templates, or maybe they're searching for an inventory company, or they're searching for something that they may really want inventory software, but not know that they need it. Right. And so if you go after those surrounding terms and provide them with inventory word tracking templates and rank for that term, then when they get to the website, they could be like, oh, I mean, this is pretty common, actually. They're like, oh, I totally need, inventory software. And I didn't even realize it. That's a bit of a jumble, but those are the three main approaches I've seen. It's going after the head terms, the long tail terms, and then related terms, and essentially redirecting someone towards your product.
Yeah, that last piece that you talked about, going for the related terms, basically the type of person that you're talking about right there is the person who doesn't necessarily know what it's called, whatever the software is that they're looking for. They don't know what it's called. They know what kinds of things that it does, but they just don't know what other people call it. You know, you might get 90% of the people would call it inventory software, and you've got these 10% of the people who would call it inventory management.
No, that's a good point.
So the second thing to do when it comes to SEO is to build a separate page for each of those keywords that you're heavily targeting. Now, as Rob was talking before, there's a lot of different approaches that you can use, and you could easily come up with hundreds and hundreds of keywords that you would want to target. Now, what you really need to do is you need to prioritize those, and then based on the competition that you're seeing from, other websites, or based on the analytics that you're doing, make a separate page for each of the keywords that you're heavily targeting. One of the things that I'm doing with Audit Shark, for example, is I'm putting something together that's kind of close to a Wikipedia entry for each of the keywords, so that appears in an education area that I'm going to have on my website, because people are searching for things like what is compliance and, what is PCI, things like that. So those are the types of things that can go onto my website, because they're obviously searching for information about those things. They're not necessarily searching for a solution yet, but if they find a website that is going to help them and it's helping them for free and doing some education for them, then they are more likely to remember that and come back and at least take a look at the sort of things that that product or that software can do for them. So that's kind of the approach that I'm taking for that. I don't think it's something you can do for every single type of site, but it can certainly work for some of them. But otherwise, what you're really trying to do is you're trying to pick what you feel are the low-hanging fruit based on your keyword research, maybe 8 pages, 10 pages to start with, something like that, and then build up those pages, build the content for them, and move on from there. If you want to expand it in the future, that's great. Obviously, it depends on which of those approaches that Rob talked about that you want to go after.
I agree. I like that idea of having an education or an articles area. I'm going to look at Hittail because it actually does all three of these approaches. There's a big head term that the homepage goes after. Then there's these kind of mid-range terms that are, I'll call body terms. They're not long tail, but they're not quite, massive traffic demons either. And so you're going to have an education area in Audit Shark. Those are kind of addressed in, it's not even one particular area, but there's like an FAQ area that has maybe 40 or 50 different pages that address different things. There's an area that's like, who would use Hittail? And then how would you use Hittail? And they target specific keywords, and they are more articles. They're not like blog posts, but they actually pose a question that gets a reasonable amount of Google traffic. Then the third one is Hittail's blog goes after long tail terms that are actually suggested by Hittail itself. That's what the previous owner was doing, right? He was using it on the site and using it to generate leads. So all three of those approaches that we talked about earlier are done on that website. And that's not something you have to do on day one, because that's a lot of effort. But I do like the thought of figuring out what your homepage is going to target, and then having like an articles or education area. I think people make a mistake. It's like your plans and pricing page, I never try to do SEO targeting with that. And your tour page, unless there's specifically searches for something that would relate to it, like I don't try to drive people directly to that. I try to get them either to the homepage or to one of your content pages, your education articles. And then the articles now should have calls to action on them, right? You don't just want someone to read that and then hit the back button and go back to the search engine. You really want it. You want to have great information. And at the bottom, you don't want to find out more? Check out our product that does exactly what we talk about above. And here's a big ass button so you can click on it. And that's quite a bit of the work that I did when I revamped the Hittail website, was that it didn't have those calls to action at the bottom. It had good articles, good content, people hitting it with organic search, but there was no now come check out our product moment. And that's, really what by plugging the funnel, I talked a lot about that over the past few months, that's exactly what it was doing.
The third thing to do when it comes to SEO is pay attention to the on-page factors. The on-page factors are important. And by on-page factors, what I really mean is the things like the page titles, the URLs, the keywords in H1 and H2 tags, things like that. I mean, the off-page factors are obviously important too. But again, in this particular podcast episode, we're just concentrating on things that are really directly under your control out of the gate. And the on-page factors are all the easiest things that you can possibly do. And a lot of people just don't do them. You know, one of the things that Rob had just mentioned was the calls to action. Now, a call to action isn't necessarily an on-page factor that's going to get you SEO results, but it will certainly help you when it comes to closing the holes in your funnel, as he said.
Right. And you mentioned H1 tags. The HTML title tag is important. And obviously having the your key phrase a couple times in the content itself. And all that stuff is quite easy to do naturally. You can really take this too far, in my opinion. I mean, it can sound mechanical, or the page can start looking weird. Like, I've seen people use bold around their keywords on the page because I think if it's emphasized, Google still takes that as it, you know, more emphasized word. It probably does. But I don't do that because I feel like it impacts readability and it feels unnatural to me. So bottom line is, if you go online and you search for best on-page factors or like on-page SEO checklist, you're going to find some different results and you're going to be able to sort out what you should do. Again, in the Academy, we have our own checklist that we put down of stuff that we know that works. What I would say is don't use meta keywords anymore. Those have faded out, and really the only purpose of them is to show your competitors what keywords you're targeting, right? No search engines use them anymore, nothing of value. So they go purely on the content. So I've actually gone through my old sites and taken out all the meta keyword tags. The keywords I don't put in, but the description you want to put in, the meta description, because it is what, that's what appears in your search result. Like when, you know, when Google has the page title is underlined, that's your blue link. And then the text that's below that is your meta description. And so that should be a call to action, right? That should show. If you don't put a meta description, Google will just grab some text that it think represents the page, which is never going to be as good as text you put there.
Really?
Yeah, I am. I thought you were serious for a moment.
No. Google's not good at something? What are you saying? That's an important distinction to make for people, that it's not all meta tags that are useless. It's just the ones like
just the
keywords
and
things like that. Yeah, you definitely want to have that description in there so that, you know, Google knows what you want to be showing up in those search results. So you can have at least a little bit of influence on what Google's showing people.
Yep.
The fourth thing that you can do is to adhere to the basics of a technically good website. And by technically good, I mean making sure that there's no broken links, you don't have invalid CSS or JavaScript pages or other links that are to pages on your site that are busted. Some of these things, that they can just dramatically slow down how fast your website loads. And, you know, I found out the effects of this one day when I was going through, it was the way WordPress was configured. There were a bunch of web pages that were being referenced. Most of them were JavaScript pages, and they just didn't exist anymore because I'd uninstalled some plugins and moved some things around. And it was taking, it was probably about twice as long to load the page than it was after I removed all these links that just didn't go anywhere. And, you know, Google looks at the page load speed and says, well, this has a factor into how high this should rank into the search engines. It's kind of unknown how much that does factor into it, but Google has made it clear that speed does matter. And, you know, so they've tried to minimize as much as they possibly can, make everything as fast as they can on their sites. And, you know, just by coming out and saying publicly that speed matters, I think it's probably a good idea to make sure that you're paying attention to how fast your website loads. So along with that, you know, you can use tools like Pingdom to test your website and your DNS. I set up a Pingdom subscription a while back just to do some DNS testing and on testing on my website. And based on that, I've kind of made some decisions about where I'm, you know, going to be moving my hosting. But those are some other simple things that you can do. And unfortunately, these are things that you kind of have to do almost after you get a web host, because you can't necessarily rely on what somebody's telling you, you know, because every web host out there is going to say, we have the fastest servers in the world. And you really have to test it for yourself, because that's not always going to be the case. The last thing about a technically good website is making sure that you're not copying and pasting content that is from other websites. So basically outright plagiarism. Google does notice duplicate content. They will mark it down. It simply won't count as much in your search engine rankings. And, you know, it's just something you have to be a little bit careful of. There are websites out there. Copyscape can tell you that sort of thing. It can keep track of, you know, whether or not your content is appearing on other people's websites. I haven't looked at it in a while. It's not something that I generally do, mainly because I don't lift content from other people's sites. But, you know, you can use that to make sure that you're not duplicating other sites too much as well.
Yeah, I think the speed thing is, people have talked about it. I think it might be underrated. I mean, I do think, you know, Google uses more than 100 factors, they say, to rank, and speed is just one factor. But they have really been putting an emphasis on this. And I believe that as we move forward with the web, like, they are going to put even more of an emphasis on it. So I think it's very important that your site loads quickly. And all the stuff you said about broken links and all that is important. And it's something you can get if you get into the Google Webmaster Tools and you plunk your site in there and you verify that you own it, they will start telling you things that they find wrong. So they'll tell you about 404s. They'll tell you about missing CSS and JavaScript and all that stuff. Definitely good to pay attention to. And they also have an area that talks about page load speed and how fast your pages are taking to load. And you can instantly, you know, if stuff's slow, you can then go download YSlow or Firebug and start trying to optimize certain pages that Google, especially your homepage and pages that get a lot of organic traffic. Bottom line is, if you improve that, I mean, that's an on-page factor. And if you improve that speed, you will improve your chance of ranking higher. They do give you tools to look at this stuff. Anything that starts appearing in the Google Webmaster Tools, almost guaranteed they're using it as a ranking factor.
The one thing I really don't like about the Google Webmaster Tools is that when they're identifying like broken links and stuff like that, when you go fix those, you can't go into the Google Webmaster Tools and say, don't show me these things anymore because I fixed them, or tell it to go out and do a rescan or something like that, so they drop off. They basically sit out there.
I think they'll drop off eventually, right? Next time they crawl, they spider the site.
I was doing a bunch of stuff and just using it to try and identify things. And, you know, I never kind of went back and verified it. It's been a while, so I could probably go back and take a look at that. But my complaint is just that you can't just go in and say, delete these, I've taken care of it. Or please verify that this is still a problem.
Right.
The fifth thing that we came up with was developing good content. Make sure that the things you write are things that people are going to want to read, because when people go searching on Google, Google will notice when somebody finds a web page, they click on a link, and then they use the back button because that wasn't the site that they were actually looking for. It just didn't apply.
That's insane, but they totally do that. And if you get a bunch of backs, they will drop your ranking. Search engines didn't used to do that, right? It didn't actually look at user behavior. And now they're doing that. You can't just write this crap content that no one wants to use, because it'll really impact your ranking negatively.
Well, the other thing is that if somebody clicks on your link and it takes forever to load, and, you know, it just shows up on the page, but it's taken forever to render for somebody, they click back, and that's a mark against you. So you're getting nailed because your site wasn't fast to begin with, and then it's getting dropped even further because you've got what Google refers to as a higher bounce rate. You know, people go to your site, and then they click the back button, and then they go searching for other things. So I guess the technical term for that is called the bounce rate. But you're basically getting dinged twice there. One of the other things in terms of good content, you can do a blog, but you don't have to. And Rob and I have both talked about this in the past. I mean, in order to write a blog, you really kind of need to be passionate about it. You know, whatever that topic is, there's got to be enough to write about. That's probably more important than being passionate about it. You've got to have a decent amount of content that you can actually churn out for it. Because if you don't, you're going to churn out a bunch of stuff and then it's going to end up stale. And you have to make sure that at that point, you don't have dates all over the stuff that basically shows everybody that that's stale content.
I actually have some thoughts on that because I'm running an experiment right now. So let me first differentiate between a personal brand blog and a company blog, right? So like Software by Rob and Single Founder for You. I mean, I take guest posts sometimes, but I would not outsource the writing of that blog, right? It's me, it's my voice. There's a very specific reason. With an app like Hittail or even, you know, .NET Invoice or something, I am actually experimenting right now. I've hired two bloggers. And they are experienced, they're knowledgeable, native English speakers, they're knowledgeable in SEO, conversion rates, search engine marketing, and social media marketing, that kind of stuff. So it really is in the Hittail wheelhouse. And they're not just kind of paid copywriters, you know, and they're not just people who crank out SEO articles for $5 a pop. And these blog posts are going to cost me a decent chunk of change. And I have two of them each working on two articles right now based on keywords that Hittail has given me. And I'm going to have them start updating the blog basically alternating. So each one will do one post a week. And depending on the traffic I see from that and the conversions I get from it, I may have them, you know, each start doing once a week, which would obviously have two updates a week. Now, I've seen this done successfully. Kissmetrics does a fantastic job. If you go to blog.kissmetrics.com, there is maybe one post out of four or five is actually from a Kissmetrics employee, and it's typically like the CEO. The others are either from, I think most of them are hired writers. They're solid material. And not only are they good content, but they get linked to, they get tweeted about, and I know that they are getting organic search traffic for that. So there is an alternate approach, right? But it does take money, especially to do it well. Again, these are not $5 blog posts. These things are going to run, depending on how long they are, I mean, they're going to run between $25 and $150 per post. You either need, you know, some funding up front, or you need to have some revenue in order to be able to get this going. In addition, like you said, if I owned a construction firm or a company that made parts for toilets or something, like, I wouldn't have a blog. I mean, maybe I'd have one about repairing toilets, but I wouldn't. You can only write so much about certain topics. It just so happens that, you know, Kissmetrics is in that, in the conversion business, and Hittail has a lot. There's always stuff to write about long tail SEO and getting traffic to your website and all that. So it does help to be in a niche where that actually makes sense, where there is some organic traffic, and where, you know, where you can create a lot of content. But obviously, I'll keep, you know, listeners posted on how that experiment goes. But so far, it's I'm pretty optimistic.
One of the questions I had for you, Rob, was that when you're developing content for your sites, Google seems like it prefers fresh content, you know, and that's why a lot of people's advice is to, oh, well, you got a website, make a blog, you know, because it seems logical. I mean, because Google's looking for fresh content. But do you think that something like rotating content helps in this regard? Because robots don't necessarily know what the page is that they're going to be viewing. And they're basically just getting a snapshot. They're not looking at a page and then seeing that, oh, this one little area of the site is different, so I'm going to treat that as a different update from the last time I was here. Or maybe they do differentials on the back end. I mean, it's hard to tell what Google's really doing. But do you think some of those things that are minor updates between one query and the next from the robots are going to make a world of difference or no?
So you mean like if you have your homepage and then maybe on your sidebar you had like a little Twitter feed that feeds new Twitter content or even feeds some recent blog posts there? Is that what you're thinking?
That was the first thing that came to mind. I'm also thinking of things like some pages will have like rotating advertisements, but you know, it's for your own product, but it's different things that you want to highlight about the product. Mm-hmm. And obviously you can only show one of them at a time when the browser loads. There's JavaScript that's just, it's not going to turn the page while the robot's loading the page or anything. Mm-hmm. How much do you think that really affects it? I mean, my inclination would be not much.
Yeah. So here's the thing. If you have a homepage or you have kind of a higher traffic page, you want to focus that on some keywords that it ranks well for, and you're going to go out and you're going to build links. These are the off-page factors we're not really going to talk about today, but you're going to build links to that page, try to get people to link to it, and you want that to be pretty static because those links contain link text, and you don't want to necessarily start try to rank for different stuff. And so once the text is static on that page and it ranks well, I tend to leave it alone. I don't muck with stuff. If you want to rank for different keywords or new keywords, that's where I go out and I write a new blog post or new article, something like that. So I know what you're talking about where, you know, having new content on your site makes Google crawl it more frequently is what happens. But I don't think you want to change. I wouldn't recommend changing content on a page. I would recommend just adding new pages like a blog does. A blog makes it really easy to just constantly add, you know, one or two new pages a week. And that will make Google come back more frequently. And that's, again, supposedly one of the signals it uses is, if this site was updated last time 4 years ago, that's the last time we saw a new page on it, it is likely going to rank lower than something that, you know, has a new article published every week that seems to be getting links and tweets about it. I think in the old days, before the caffeine update a couple years ago, it was more like the older your site, the better. But Google is doing more and more real-time stuff. They were using the Twitter Firehose for a while. They don't have it anymore, but now they have the Google Plus stuff. So they want more up-to-date, quick, often updated stuff. And so I do think there's value in having changing content on your site, but it's not changing a particular page. It's more just new content and fresh content added as new pages.
So I think that pretty much wraps it up for the five best things that we could come up with when it comes to SEO. And again, these are just the basics of, you know, doing on-page SEO. And once you've got these basics down, you can concentrate on a lot of the off-page factors, such as building incoming links, using directory submissions, writing articles and posting them on other sites or guest blog submissions, press releases, things like that. But you basically have to have a site for people to link to that you've targeted for your users before you can start doing those off-page factors. And you could do some of it at the same time, but it's a little bit more difficult when you don't necessarily have pages where you can send people to from those articles or those guest posts.
Yeah, and obviously there's way more than we can cover in a single podcast. We do have several lessons in micropreneur.com, the academy, that go into more depth in terms of on-page and off-page factors. And, you know, obviously there are other resources across the web where you can get that kind of info as well. If you have a question or comment, please call it into our voicemail number at 888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. And if you want to subscribe to this podcast, please log into iTunes and search for Startups. A full transcript will be available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.